Now New York City, Seven Stories Press, and the Center for Constitutional Rights celebrate the release of Nancy Chang's new book, Silencing Political Dissent, How Post-September 11th Anti-Terrorism Measures Threaten Our Civil Liberties. The event is part of National Organization of Women's Now New York City Take Back America Lecture Series. The date today is Thursday, September 19th. The talk will begin at 7 p.m. We are at this moment at the Community Services Society that is 105 East 22nd Street in New York City. And Nancy Chang will be speaking again on her book and other issues, Silencing Political Dissent, How Post-September 11th Anti-Terrorism Measures Threaten Our Civil Liberties.
And it's interesting to note that since 1950, the amount of taxations, that the amount of taxes that the corporations are contributing toward the support of our court system has shrunk from 30% to 10%. So the very courts that 90% of the individual's taxes are paying for are now closed to us if we want a job. A month later, on April 24th, 2001, again, long before September 11th, the U.S. Supreme Court made another sweeping decision. This case was Gil Atwater versus Lago Vista, Texas. And that decision said, we're now going to gut the Fourth Amendment. We're going to make it legal for the police to arrest you and jail you for minor offenses. The great offense that Gail Atwater had committed landed her in jail was she was not wearing her seatbelt, driving in a back street at about 15 miles an hour. Even Sandra Day O'Connor felt that this decision was an outrage and wrote a scathing dissent. Then 5 weeks after that decision, Now New York City and the New York Civil Liberties Union held a press conference to announce that we were filing a lawsuit against New York City and the New York Police Department. We had just learned the hard way through the arrest of one of our board members, myself, that happened to be, that the city under the Giuliani administration had put in place a secret policy that if you were engaging in political protest and happened to be in a group of 20 or more protesters, you could be arrested, jailed, and what they call put through the system, which means you could be held for 3 days. The late Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said, we can either have democracy in this country or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. Today, Bill Gates' wealth of $51 billion is larger than that of 40% of our nation's poorest people. 1% of the population controls 44% of the nation's wealth. GE's Jack Welch receives retirement perks reminiscent of kings or oligarchs, while many of the company's workers are now classified as daily hires and have to call in on Tuesdays to see if they can feed their family the following week. Tyco's former general counsel, Mark Belnick, files a retention agreement with the SEC. And let me tell you, it is nauseating to see a federal government's website, sec.gov, carrying a retention agreement for the general counsel of what had been one of our largest corporations that says the following. If I am charged with a felony, I will receive a bonus of $10.6 million. The current Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, cashed out of Enron for $12 million. Paul Krugman this week let us know that followed the Secretary of the Army sending an email that said, hide losses. He's now expected to lead the men and women of our Army, many of whom are living on food stamps. This is the sad and wretched state of our democracy. This is the tattered and defiled condition of our Bill of Rights. And on that note, I'll turn the podium over to Nancy Chang, the senior litigation attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights, and she'll tell you what else now we're being asked to turn a blind eye to in the name of protecting our democracy.
Thank you so much, Pam, for the lovely reception here and for all the care and attention you put into organizing tonight's event. I'm especially delighted to be here as part of NOW's Take Back America lecture series. I've been a fan of NOW since I was a small girl, and I can truthfully say that this organization and its path-breaking work changed the direction of my life. My mother got me off to a really great start as a feminist because she had been born in a feudal Chinese society nearly 90 years ago, and she was raised in a culture in which the birth of a son was cause for celebration, while the birth of a daughter was viewed as a missed opportunity to gain a son. She broke with tradition. She refused to have her feet bound. She insisted on receiving a proper education, and she married for love rather than by family arrangement. And in her role as a mother, she let me know in every way possible that she held the same high expectations for me as for my brothers. But by the time I was in college and exploring career options, women and people of color had made very few inroads into the legal profession. At its upper echelons, it was almost exclusively a white male bastion. And the women of NOW helped me realize that breaking down the doors to the legal profession could be an adventure. I'm also very delighted that this event is being sponsored by Seven Stories Press, which has published my book, Silencing Political Dissent, and by the Center for Constitutional Rights, where I've been practicing as an attorney for 6 years, and which asked me to write this book as part of its public education and outreach campaign around September 11th. Since September 11th, Greg Ruggiero and Dan Simon at Seven Stories Press have played a vital role in bringing forward views that are not aired in the mainstream press, and for that, I think we're all very appreciative. The Center for Constitutional Rights is a progressive nonprofit legal organization here in New York, and it has played a leadership role in challenging September 11th anti-terrorism measures that violate the Constitution and international human rights norms. A full year now separates us from the horrific events of September 11th. It is a year in which tremendous violence has been done in the name of national security to the principles that form the core of our democracy. The framers of our Constitution understood from their dealings with their King George, and I'm not making reference to any American president here, that the accumulation of all power, legislative, executive, and judicial, in the same hands may justly be pronounced the definition of tyranny. But the genius of the framers has not prevented the Bush administration from strong-arming a panic-stricken Congress into passing sweeping anti-terrorism legislation and by reporting that more terrorist attacks were soon to come. Tucked into this complex and lengthy piece of legislation is the executive branch's long-standing wish list of law enforcement tools. Nor did the framers' genius prevent the Bush administration from unilaterally issuing executive orders and interim rules where the Congress has not provided them with the authorization that they sought. By exercising these powers behind a cloak of secrecy, the executive branch has largely succeeded in evading oversight by the Congress and the judiciary and in evading scrutiny from the public and the press. We've seen a shift, an unprecedented and largely of power that's been largely unchecked power to the executive branch in the year, and this has been disastrous for the Bill of Rights. Perhaps the hardest hit victims of the post-11th anti-terrorism measures have been the thousands of Muslims and nationals of Arab and South Asian countries who have been targeted by the FBI and the INS for questioning and arrest and secretly held in preventive detention. Since last October, Attorney General John Ashcroft made a bone-chilling pledge. He said, "Let the terrorists among us be warned. If you overstay your visa, even by one day, we will arrest you. If you violate a local law, you will be put in jail and kept in custody as long as possible. We will use every available statute. We will seek every prosecutorial advantage." Well, the Attorney General has more than carried through on this pledge. He has held the detainees for weeks and even months on end without providing them of the notice of the charges on which they are being held. He has denied them access to their attorneys, their families, their friends, their consulates, and organizations concerned with their welfare. And he has closed immigration hearings to the press and public. He's also denied them release on bond, and he has confined them in punishing and often dangerous conditions. He has also issued rules that allow the Department of Justice to monitor their communications with their attorneys without a court order. Through these actions, the Attorney General has shown his contempt for the United States Constitution, whose due process clause requires the government to provide all persons in its custody, regardless of whether they are citizens or non-citizens, with fundamentally fair procedures for challenging their detention. Through these actions, the Attorney General has also reversed the hard-won progress made by the civil rights community before September 11th in combating racial profiling in law enforcement. Not a single detainee caught up in this dragnet has been arrested for a terrorism-related crime. These unjustified detentions do not make us safer. They make us less safe. One of the important lessons we have learned in the past year is that we need to connect the dots in a huge mound of intelligence information. Our government needs Arab and Muslim communities, both at home and abroad, and their cooperation, their translation services, and their human intelligence services, if it is to connect the dots in what is by now a far larger mound of intelligence information. These communities are unlikely to come to the aid of a nation that denies to Arabs and Muslims the due process of law to which they are entitled. As a matter of reciprocity, our government may find that it lacks the moral authority to protect the citizens of its country from similar mistreatment at the hands of foreign powers. Those of us who are United States citizens should not be complacent in thinking that our citizenship protects us from arbitrary detention. As we have seen in recent months, arbitrary detention has not been reserved solely for non-citizens in the cases of Yasser Hamdi, an alleged Taliban fighter, and Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber, both of whom are U.S. citizens. The Bush administration has staked out the extraordinary position that it has the power to detain citizens indefinitely when the military has labeled them as enemy combatants, without charging them with a crime, without allowing them access to counsel, without presenting them with evidence on which the detention is based, and without allowing them access to the courts, much less to a speedy trial or a fair trial before an impartial arbiter. This position simply cannot be reconciled with the rule of law, which is the bedrock principle that separates us from the arbitrary exercise of power. Hopefully, our courts will not abdicate their jurisdiction to review the military's designation of U.S. citizens as enemy combatants. If they do so, it is hard to understand what would prevent the military from labeling all of us in this room, for instance, as enemy combatants, locking us up in a Navy brig off the coast of South Carolina and throwing away the key. Hamdi and Padilla may have committed acts harmful to the interests of the United States, and they may be deserving of punishment, but their cases belong in the criminal justice system and not in some dark corner of the military justice system. Our government has gone down a slippery slope in deciding to deprive enemy combatants of the procedural fairness demanded of the Constitution. While the detentions of enemy combatants and the detention of non-citizens on the pretext of minor immigration violations, such as overstaying one's visa by one day, may be the most visible and dramatic evidence that our civil liberties are under attack, what we have not been allowed to see should trouble us just as much as what we have been allowed to see. The USA Patriot Act, and not to get too Orwellian, but that stands for the Uniting and Strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism act of 2001. The USA Patriot Act brought a vast expansion of the government's power to conduct surveillance. Among the new tools it gained are the ability to track personal sensitive records and items sought for an investigation to protect against international terrorism, the ability to conduct sneak and peek searches in which the search is conducted without prior notice to the owner of the premises, nationwide roving wiretaps, and the expanded availability of warrants under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is a law that allows the government to sidestep the probable cause requirement of the Fourth Amendment whenever it has a significant purpose of foreign intelligence gathering. The Department of Justice has fought extremely hard to keep its implementation of the act a secret. In fact, this summer it rudely rebuffed a request for this information made by the House Judiciary Committee, the House committee to which responsibility for overseeing implementation of the act and ensuring its compliance with the Constitution has been delegated. The Bush administration displayed its disdain for Congress when the Department of Justice told the House Judiciary Committee that it was not going to share information with it, but it was willing to share information with the intelligence committees which, as last I heard anyway, do not have the protection of civil liberties as their chief mandate. Human nature being what it is, we must expect that law enforcement agents will misuse and even abuse their new surveillance powers, and as a result, innocent persons who have no involvement with terrorism or crime will have their privacy intruded upon. In fact, the first published decision of the highly secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which was released in August, reveals that the Department of Justice had submitted 75 affidavits containing false information in support of applications for warrants from that court. At the same time the government's surveillance powers have expanded, recent technological advances have exponentially increased the government's ability to track both our real footprints and our electronic footprints. Between our image being caught by video cameras that scan all our public spaces, our credit card charges, our ATM and bank transactions, our EasyPass records, our emails, our telephone calls, our voicemails, and the cookies left by our computers when we web surf. The records created when we use electronic key cards and identification cards. At this point, I think it's naive to believe that privacy continues to exist. I should also mention the proliferation of data mining companies whose business it is to collect information from us, pieced together from public records, including records of our birth, marriages, death, our real estate transactions, court proceedings, our transgressions of the law, and along with web postings and the store, hotel, car rental, and credit card company information. That between all of these sources, these companies know quite a bit about us, and they sell their products to not just private consumers, but the government as well. Of course, there are also new technologies, like Carnivore, which has the ability to scour through internet data, the Magic Lantern, which has the ability to keylog and determine and pass encryption methods, and the facial recognition systems that we've heard about. I should also mention that, in passing, that there are low-tech surveillance methods that have made a resurgence, like Operation TIPS, the program that will have millions of Americans with no training in the law spying on their fellow citizens. In addition to the loss of privacy in the year since September 11th, we have seen a narrowing of the public discourse and a silencing of political dissent. I will speak more about these infringements on our First Amendment values shortly. But first, I'd like to take a detour and examine the past and the important lessons that it has to offer for us at the present moment. The Bill of Rights, which consists of the first 10 amendments of the United States Constitution and which collectively guarantee Americans the political freedoms and individual liberties essential to an open and democratic society, is a permanent fixture in the American legal landscape. Its provisions remain in force even during times of crisis. But our nation's history is marred by many instances in which, in the face of a perceived national security threat, we have acted irrationally by denying the protections of the Constitution to individuals and groups that have fallen out of favor, out of fear, whether warranted or the product of fabricated hysteria. We have allowed suspicion to substitute for fact. Only after the threat has long been dissipated have we acknowledged error and expressed our shame and regret for having deviated from the core principles that bind us as a nation. As one might expect, a number of these incidents have involved government efforts to silence opponents of war drives. For example, in World War I, Congress criminalized political dissent under the Espionage of 1917. The Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of that act against a First Amendment challenge when it affirmed the criminal conviction and 10-year prison sentence of socialist labor leader Eugene Debs because he had delivered an impassioned anti-war speech in Canton, Ohio, while the United States was at war with Germany, in which he counseled those in the audience of conscription age, "You need to know that you are fit for something better than slavery and cannon fodder." Similarly, a number of these incidents have involved government monitoring of and interference with political movements that have been perceived as a threat to the status quo. During the Cold War, surveillance of those suspected of leftist views ran rampant, and then between 1956 and 1971, the FBI operated a secret counterintelligence program dubbed COINTELPRO that covertly spied on and disrupted law-abiding political organizations engaged in activities protected by the First Amendment. According to a memo written by J. Edgar Hoover on May 9, 1969, its mission was to, and I quote, "expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and otherwise neutralize activities of individuals and organizations perceived by the government to pose a threat to domestic interests." COINTELPRO's initial targets were the Communist Party and the Socialist Workers' Party, but it later turned its attention to the civil rights movement, the black nationalist movement, the white supremacist movement, the women's liberation movement, and groups opposed to the Vietnam War. Notwithstanding the fact that we are a nation of immigrants, there are also a number of incidents that have been triggered by international tensions that have led to the demonization of immigrants from countries with which we have found ourselves at odds. The Red Scare that followed the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 brought the notorious Palmer Raids, which saw the roundup and deportation of thousands of immigrants, none of whom was shown to pose a threat to the United States. Even more disturbing was the forced internment of more than 110,000 individuals of Japanese descent living on the West Coast following the bombing of Pearl Harbor during World War II. Unfortunately, rather than learn from our mistakes, we seem to be intent on repeating them. This is particularly troubling because the civil liberties that we have lost since September 11th are likely to be lost to us forever. Our earlier cases, our crises, eventually came to a resolution, after which we restored and in some cases even strengthened our national commitment to civil liberties. But the war on terrorism is an ideological war against an amorphous enemy that knows no geographical bounds. Such a war runs the danger of continuing without end. Even if the threat of terrorism were to be eradicated, it would be against the Bush administration's self-interest to let us know, as it would then be forced to relinquish its wartime powers. To complicate matters further, our nation is perched on the precipice of a war with Iraq. It is precisely when military action is being threatened that our commitment to the First Amendment is most essential. At such times, decisions must be made on the weightiest of matters, whether to declare war, whether to take military action, whether to compel military service, whether to curtail our political and personal freedoms, whom to call friend and whom to call foe. The specter of casualties, both military and civilian, and foreign American and civilian, military and civilian, and American and foreign, looms in the balance. Once made, these decisions are certain to carry long-lasting repercussions extending far beyond the geographical confines of the United States. Public participation in decision-making is the hallmark of a democratic society. Open debate that invites the vigorous presentation of opposing views both enriches our understanding of the problems and the challenges and helps us to find innovative solutions. Yet, ironically, it is precisely at moments like the present, when the national security is under threat, that First Amendment values are most likely to be abandoned in favor of authoritarian rule. With a growing sense of uneasiness, we have witnessed the Bush administration, in its effort to maintain a free hand in the exercise of its new powers, employ strategies that are calculated to silence political dissent. It has questioned the patriotism of those who oppose its policies, thereby fostering a climate of intolerance and dissent. It has sought to discourage political activism by imposing guilt by association, and it has restricted access to government information, which has stymied the press, the public, the Congress, and to some extent perhaps the judiciary in their efforts to hold the executive accountable for its actions. Since the Boston Tea Party, strong social movements employing confrontational methods of protest have played a vital role in the struggle for political and social justice in the United States. Our nation's independence from Great Britain, the abolition of slavery, suffrage for women, the passage of the federal civil rights legislation, and the withdrawal of American troops from Vietnam were won not by academic debate or goodwill of the administrations, but by the force of vibrant mass movements that challenge the status quo. Drawing inspiration from the writings of Henry David Thoreau and Mohandas Gandhi, Dr. King wrote from a prison cell in Birmingham that an individual who breaks the law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the society over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest regard for law. The costs of confrontational protests, which were already considerable before September 11th, have risen sharply. Political activists and organizations with which they associate are more likely than ever to become the targets of government tracking, surveillance, infiltration, and even criminal prosecution as the result of the Act's creation of a new federal crime of domestic terrorism that stretches beyond recognition the common understanding of the term terrorism as premeditated and politically motivated violence against a civilian population. The new crime's wide ambit extends to, and I'm quoting, any acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws, if they appear to be intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, and if they occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. The looseness of this definition allows the government to group nonviolent civil disobedience in the tradition of Thoreau, Gandhi, and King, together with al-Qaeda's ruthless attacks on civilians, all under the single banner of terrorism. For example, acts of civil disobedience that take place in the United States necessarily meet three of the five elements of the definition of domestic terrorism. They constitute a violation of the criminal laws. They are intended to influence the policy of a government, and they occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. And many acts of civil disobedience, including blocking streets and points of egress by nonviolent means during a demonstration or sit-in, could be construed as acts dangerous to human life that appear to be intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, in which case the crime's two remaining elements would be met. Spontaneous clashes between protesters and police officers in the course of a heated demonstration could also be construed as acts falling within the crime's reach. As a result, protest activities that previously would have ended with a charge of disorderly conduct under a local ordinance can now result in law enforcement surveillance of the group and even federal prosecution and conviction for terrorism. Experience has taught us that when prosecutors are entrusted with the discretion to file inflated charges for minor crimes, politically motivated prosecutions, and the exertion of undue pressure on activists to turn state's witness or to serve as government informants are not far behind. With the Patriot Act's grant of enhanced and largely unchecked surveillance powers to the executive branch, and the technological advances that are being made in the field of surveillance, the stage has been set for a replay of the worst abuses of the FBI's infamous COINTEL program. The political freedoms guaranteed to us by the First Amendment, the freedom of speech and association, the right to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances, and freedom of the press, are essential elements for social change and for the stability of our nation. As Justice Brandeis observed, those who won our independence knew that it is hazardous to discourage thought, hope, and imagination, that fear breeds repression, that repression breeds hate, that hate menaces stable government, that the path of safety lies in the opportunity to discuss freely supposed grievances and proposed remedies, that the fitting remedy for evil counsels is good ones. Unfortunately, the Bush administration has chosen to disregard Justice Brandeis's wise words. Invoking the crisis at hand, the administration has warned Americans to watch what they say and watch who they associate with, and it has sought to prevent the public, the press, the Congress, and even the judiciary from overseeing its actions. These measures are calculated to silence political dissent, and they threaten the vitality of our democracy. Before it is too late and the Bill of Rights is robbed of all vitality, we must take stock of the state of our civil liberties to prevent their further erosion and to reverse the damage that has already been done. Our civil liberties will be lost to us permanently unless we struggle to reclaim them. We must not allow ourselves to engage in self-censorship, but must instead speak our minds. Our best hope for the peaceful resolution of conflict and our future safety lies in the expansion rather than the contraction of the democratic values set forth in the Constitution. I'd like to quote Margaret Mead, who said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." One of the concrete tasks that we can work on is a campaign to make sure that the USA Patriot Act surveillance provisions that are scheduled to sunset or expire in December of 2005 are not reenacted into law. At the same time, we should seek to repeal of the permanent provisions of that act that infringe on our civil liberties. Another concrete task is to join the local movements to take the defensive by blocking state and local anti-terrorism measures that infringe on civil liberties and to take the offensive by getting civil liberties resolutions passed. We also need to keep in mind that the draconian changes in the Immigration and Nationality Act brought in by the USA Patriot Act places non-citizens at risk of deportation and detention when they engage in certain political activities in support of their organizations that the government considers or might at some future point consider with a change in world events, terrorist organizations. Those of us who are citizens need to take the lead in voicing the concerns of non-citizens. Of course, public education, political organizing, and protest are key. Political justice only comes about as a result of a strong social movement. And we cannot forget the role of the judiciary, which will be the ultimate arbiter of the constitutionality of the anti-terrorism measures. A number of issues have already been considered by the lower courts, and in a telling sign of how far the Bush administration has overreached, many judges have refused to defer to the political branches of government, as they generally do in times of crisis, and have instead ruled that the administration's actions are unconstitutional. Some of these issues may work their way up to the Supreme Court in short order. I'd just like to mention a few of these decisions. We have a case in the Sixth Circuit involving the closure of immigration judge hearings to the public and the press. The challenge was brought by media plaintiffs, the Detroit Free Press and others, and Judge Damon Keith, who is a civil rights hero, who back in the Nixon years as a district court judge said no to the Nixon administration when it sought to warrantless searches of domestic terrorists. Judge Damon Keith stated that democracy dies behind closed doors. Judge Gladys Kessler in D.C., in response to a Freedom of Information Act request for the names of the INS detainees, said that secret arrests were odious in a democratic society. Well, I've taken up more than enough of your time, and I thank you for being such a great audience. I will be happy to take your questions, but I have two requests to make before that. First, my office, the Center for Constitutional Rights, is a progressive nonprofit legal organization, and I think it goes without saying that we don't get any government funding. And the Center for Constitutional Rights is litigating a number of the legal challenges against the government and its overreaching. And in the days since September 11th. And we would very much appreciate your donations to maintain our work. I very much hope that you will consider becoming a supporter of the organization. We have a table outside staffed by two employees of the center, Carolyn Chambers and Melissa Anderson, and we have a website, which is www.ccr-ny.org. My second request is directed to the organization and to all the women in the audience. And it is that we desperately need you to join the struggle to preserve our Bill of Rights because, in my observation, both in my personal and professional life, it's when women get behind a project that things really start to happen. So thank you, everyone, and for coming out tonight. And I'd be very happy to take some questions.